Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-hour home care.
And the reason is we were getting beat by local home care agencies. Yeah. And we were like, man, we don't have a lot of, we didn't have a big field marketing field rep team. We didn't have a lot of boots on the ground. And so we suddenly found ourselves doing home safety inspections, home audits, drop-ins, and in-person consultations. And I'm like, what the hell? This is not a tech company anymore.
In many ways, the story of Home Hero paints the picture of a classic California startup. Born from the need to help his family track the caregivers hired to help his grandmother, CEO Kyle Hill and his simple app quickly attracted the eye of major venture capital investors. Following the build-out of a full app, their $20 million Series A funding round launched Home Hero into the forefront of public perception of non-medical home care. Home Hero and other technology-based home care companies such as Honor and Home Team promised to disrupt the industry with cutting-edge technology and business models. However, the home care industry is one built heavily on relationships, and the disruption was not as straightforward as initially thought. Following this realization and a barrage of new regulatory hurdles, and just 4 years after exploding onto the scene, Kyle and Home Hero announced that they would be ceasing operations immediately, ending their run almost as quickly as it began. Kyle announced their move in a Medium article and has been mostly silent, until now. Join us on the journey of Home Hero and what went wrong, as well as a look at the new company and direction Kyle and the Home Hero team are headed. Be sure to stick around till the end for a special offer from Kyle to the listeners of our podcast. You may also have noticed that we've recently begun releasing episodes weekly. We have so many great guests in store for you, including Dr. David Feinberg, former UCLA and current Geisinger Health President and CEO, California Health and Human Services Secretary Diana Dooley, CAPG President Don Crane, Providence St. Joseph CEO Eric Wexler, and many more. So we've decided to release an episode per week for the start of summer. Please follow us on iTunes in the podcast store or on Stitcher so that you don't miss an episode. We'd also appreciate if you could like and comment on Pop Health Podcast so that we can continue to attract more listeners. You can find us online at pophealthpodcast.com and always find me on Twitter at pophealthzach. I'd love to connect with you there. As always, thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
So Kyle, we want to get to know a little bit about you before we get into the kind of nitty gritty of why you're here today. So tell us a little bit about maybe your background, where you grew up, maybe went to college. I know there's a little bit of love for soccer as well, so I'd love to hear a little bit about that. And then also after that, maybe transition into your tech background and then eventually how you got into home care.
Yeah, sure. And thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah,
super happy to be here. So I went to high school out in Ohio, and I was a big Buckeye fan, grew up, played soccer at Pomona College out in Claremont, California. And I was an econ major, came out, worked in finance for a couple of years, and then realized that I wanted to do something a little more scalable, a little more creative. And didn't take me long to meet Mike, who's now my co-founder. And we have now started, four different companies together.
So, wow.
We've definitely have very complementary skill sets, and we met back in 2011 in Los Angeles when the tech scene in LA really there was only comprised of a few co-working spaces and maybe an accelerator or two, but the tech boom hadn't really happened yet, and so we were hacking on code in a little co-working space in Santa Monica and
pre-Silicon Beach.
Yeah, and I nice. it really was in the infancy stages of what it is today, and we started a company called FlowTab. It was a mobile ordering and payments application for bars and nightclubs. We also had started a company called Zing Check. Checkout, which was a web-based point-of-sale system. Zing Checkout actually came first, and it ended up getting acquired by BigCommerce leading up to their IPO. But Mike and I had both left before that happened to start FlowTab, which was more of the consumer side to the point-of-sale system. And the idea was to allow people to order and pay for their drinks in bars and nightclubs and allow them to kind of facilitate the ordering process there. And, you know, in that process, we really got kind of our feet wet in fundraising and building a brand, building a consumer brand. And living in San Francisco, we met a ton of investors. We met a ton of engineers and really learned the basics on how to build a company, how to scale a company. We had had a little bit of success with it. It was in checkout and really wanted to do it on our own this time and learned that San Francisco is a very expensive place to live.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But it wasn't until about 2012, while working on FlowTab, that I started to see a lot of the problems my dad was having finding home care for my grandmother. And we had a really scary incident happen one day. We thought the caregiver was in the home for my grandmother. She was probably 94 at the time and pretty independent for a 94-year-old. But we thought the caregiver was there. They weren't. And they ended up leaving my grandmother there home alone for about 16 hours.
Oh, man.
And she had wet herself and she hadn't eaten. She hadn't drank any food. And we thought the caregiver was there. And so as you guys probably know, there's with most families, when they search for home care, there's a trigger point. There's a point in which they realize we need to do something about mom or dad. And that really was our trigger point. And so I started building some technology to help my dad manage the caregivers more efficiently. So it was a simple clock in and clock out system. So he would get a text message whenever the caregivers were there.
And when you say you built it, so you built it yourself?
Yeah, it was a pretty basic. We were using a Twilio API and just
idea what that means.
Yeah, just a simple text message that would notify my dad that the caregivers were there.
Cool. Sure. Nice.
And so we actually went down to Mike Jones over at Science, who was a former CEO of MySpace and runs a large accelerator called Science in Los Angeles. And I was pitching him on FlowTab and I was telling him about this thing and hated the business, didn't want to invest.
Yep.
And I showed him the application that I'd built for my dad. And he said, now this is cool.
Yeah.
I like this a lot more. This is a more exciting industry. And long story short, he said, hey, if you guys want to build a company or marketplace in the home care space, call me.
Yeah.
And it didn't take us but a couple of weeks. And we actually gave him a call back. We went and visited some home care agencies up in Oakland and said, what is this whole home care industry? And really just got a lot of guidance from Science in the early days, decided to join. And we started Home Hero.
Around when was that?
We founded the company in May of 2012. So we incorporated in 2012. We launched in January of 2013 publicly. So we'd had a number of patients through the system and caregivers, but we hadn't actually announced our launch until the January 2013.
Okay, so 2013, you guys launch. Now, I know when you launched, tell us about your workforce, a little bit about that. Were these employees of yours? I believe they were independent contractors at the time. Tell us about that.
So admittingly, in the early days, we started off as the Uber for home care, and we quickly scrapped that just because we realized that we were dealing with Uber has a very, what I call a homogenous supply pool. So all of their drivers are essentially the same. And as evidenced by the fact that they're eventually going to replace their entire workforce with driverless cars.
Right.
Travis has been very open and transparent about that being his goal. We have a heterogeneous supply pool. However, caregivers are very different. They have different skill sets. They have different experience levels. They have they're in different locations and they're different ages. And so even gender is a really important factor. So we have a matching problem in home care. And it was the first thing that I saw. Home care is very expensive. It's very fragmented. And finding a caregiver really comes down to it's a matching challenge. And so we saw an opportunity to use technology to onboard a large volume of caregivers and then use technology, a matching algorithm, to match them with patients more efficiently. So you could find somebody that had experience in Alzheimer's or dementia. You could find somebody that fit your schedule and your location on the right times. And we had backups and contingency plans on top of that. So we saw really we felt that we could improve home care delivery with technology. And so that's why we went the marketplace route. But I usually corrected people when they said Uber for home care. I said, it's got to be more personal than that.
Right. Yeah, I remember thinking, I'll get a caregiver in 5 minutes. That wasn't the case by no means.
Yeah. And if you could, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the right caregiver for you for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Right. Like this is going to be somebody that, to be frank, might be the last person your mom or dad sees, know? And so getting that match right is very important. And now doing it quickly is also important, but it's more important that you get the right person in your home.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. So started off with a large workforce of independent contractors that work for you guys. I know people knew about you really quickly. You built up. And there came a point where you made the decision to move over to W-2 employees.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that experience, why you made the decision, if there were any challenges with that, that type of thing?
Yeah, so I've always believed that the only way that this business is scalable to the point where you can, I use $100 million exit as kind of the as kind of a benchmark of what a lot of these VCs are looking for. And so I felt that the only way we were going to do that is to build something that was scalable. And you know, when we raised our $20 million A, we had about 1,400 caregivers across California.
Wow.
And there's no way we would have had that many caregivers with the W-2 model. And so it was very important that we had just liquidity in that market. So when we found somebody in, you know, in even like Northern Malibu, we'd have caregivers there. And so,
right.
And on the flip side, it was very difficult to have somebody sitting on salary or staff and giving them benefits and everything else, not working.
Yeah.
And so that was a big challenge. The decision to go W-2 was very complicated. The largest factor there was the Department of Labor ruling. It essentially was waging war on the W-2 workforce.
Right.
And we can talk about how the state regulations and the federal regulations conflicted a little bit on
right.
that. And so, yes, you could say, yeah, well, there's still domestic referral agencies in California, but we felt as a domestic referral agency in California, where there is this carve out, that we wouldn't be able to have those same protections in other states.
Right.
And so for a company that had expectations to be a national player, we felt that it was an immense amount of pressure. We had an immense amount of pressure on us to change. So that was part of it. The second part of it was probably a little bit of a quality issue. When you have a workforce where this may not be their primary source of income, which it was the case for some caregivers, not all of them, but some, it's a matter of priority. And so you're going to get a higher quality service by going W-2. It doesn't mean that you can't train these caregivers. I think that's BS, that you can totally train your 1099 workforce. It just can't look like training to lawyers. And let's just
right.
be honest.
right.
And so you can give them suggestions yeah. of how to do their job better. You can't give them checklists of things that they have to do in the home.
Yeah.
So I didn't believe that was it. But you have a higher level of accountability on the caregivers. It's not necessarily you can't train them. And then the third reason was really going after hospital contracts. We had a lot of conversations with hospital and health systems and learned that they were holding their caregivers. If there was going to be, if we were going to accept any reimbursement or we were going to get hospitals and health systems to pay for non-medical home care, they were going to hold the caregivers to the same screening standards as their nurses in their hospitals. And
right.
so,
yeah.
and that cost us $300 to $500 to go through all those hoops. And it didn't make sense from a financial perspective for us to spend that on a caregiver that was going to leave us or leave the platform in a couple months.
Right.
Yeah.
And just to clarify for the listeners who probably know, because we've had the Home Care Services Bureau on the podcast before, but on January 1st of 2016, officially in California, home care agencies had to be licensed. Creation of the Home Care Services Bureau, also a whole host of financial and regulatory hoops mm-hmm. added onto that. And as far as the cost that Kyle referenced, just over $5,000 per location of the agency. And yeah, the costs anywhere from $100 to a couple hundred dollars per caregiver is what we found for background checks and for different things that they need in order to be registered through the state for the Home Care Services Bureau. That being said, the creation of that law didn't eliminate registries. There are still registries out there.
Really?
Was there ever a point that you guys considered just going that route instead of going, you know, for the hospital contracts or different things like that? Or was the hospital contracts and that kind of agency always what your trajectory was?
Well, look, I still believe the only way you're going to get a large venture exit in the home care space is by having a large workforce that you do not employ. That doesn't mean that all other home care agencies, the model's just different, right?
Yeah,
it's just it's a franchise model. You guys have a unique model and you're independent. That's totally fine, but to return $150 million, $250 million of venture, you need a massive force of caregivers,
right.
and doing that in a W-2 capacity just is very challenging. I mean, are we going to have 1,000 caregivers? We're going to be Cisco? Like that's just a major undertaking.
Yeah.
There was a couple other models that we considered. CareLinx actually has a very interesting model where they put the onus of employing the caregiver onto the family, and they provide tools to allow them to manage that care. But at the end of the day, I mean, most of the industry, like, let's be honest, just goes under the table, and they pay somebody in cash or other services, and, you know, or even live-in arrangements and form a rent. So we were trying to find a way to do it without owning the caregivers. Right. But health systems was really the blocker. I mean, we were talking to a couple of health systems, and they said, oh, you guys don't employ the caregivers. It's so easy for the lawyers and compliance to say, no, we're not going to do this.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So you talked about you raised a bunch of capital and you want to get a return on that investment for your funders, if you will. There's other companies out there. There's actually one in the news today in Chicago that is looking to raise quite a bit of money. And they had mentioned companies like Honor and your organization as well. And they said they were, you know, trying to raise all this money. And I was curious from your perspective, how you think folks who use that model, how they'll do. Will they get that quick turnaround? Can they get to $250 million in a couple of years? Just curious from your thoughts. You kind of touched on already, but.
Well, I get asked about Honor and Home Team like on a daily basis, at least when I was in the industry. Yeah. And my answer is always the same. I would not bet against those guys. They're very, very talented, smart guys, Josh and Seth especially. I would not bet against either of those guys. They're very smart. They know how to iterate. They know how, they absorb a lot of information. They're very well connected. And they're good at fundraising. They're good leaders of their team. So I don't know what those guys are working on. And I don't know that they're going to return that capital doing exactly what they're doing today, but it's so hard to know how the business evolves over time. And so, you know, I think Home Team is probably most different from us. They were going after a lot of Medicaid, and they just had a slightly different regulatory environment in New York. And so the businesses are just inherently going to be different than us in Honor in California. Look, I think home care, as I mentioned a little bit in my Medium article, it's still a very attractive market. It's large, it's growing fast. The metric that we always use in fundraising was that the ratio of available caregivers to seniors right now is about 7 to 1. By, I think it's 2025 or 2030, it's going to go down to about 3 to 1.
Right.
So we have this dearth of caregivers. We're going to have this dearth of caregivers, and it's got to be met by someone. The challenge right now is that I don't see any technology providers coming into space and actually reducing the cost of home care while maintaining a quality requirement. And so there's no new technology that I've seen that's been able to do that. And one of the things we'd always looked at is like, well, is there an option to making like a we called it sharegiver.
Yeah.
So we said, is there an option to have maybe almost like an adult daycare, but where you can have two seniors in the home at the same time with the same caregiver, and now your costs are half of what they are. And maybe you can pay the caregiver a little more, right?
Right.
But there's no like new model that I've seen that, you know, and again, I go back to CareLinks, like that was a kind of a new model that they were trying. They've had pretty good success there, but I just think that somebody has to come in and do things inherently different than what's being done before, and in order to have a really big success here.
Okay. So affordability is a big thing, obviously. So there's other groups out there providing care in the home that most people would say are affordable. And examples of that would be home health, because the patient receiving care, it may be covered by their insurance. So they think that's affordable. But what they don't know is that home health care provider might be getting $100 for a 1-hour visit, and it's really Medicare. So while home care may be perceived as not affordable for many or most, the reality is it's actually much less costly than these other services, but the consumers don't see those other bills. So I was curious, do you think in the future, do you see Medicare funding it? Do you see insurers funding it? What would be needed to get there?
Absolutely. And they already are. And I think with the advent of bundled payments, and I think it's going to take a while, but we spent a lot of time at Home Hero really trying to prove the actuarial value of home care as a way of reducing readmissions and how it was a cheaper alternative to skilled nursing. I think the theme that is in favor for the home care industry is that people want to be discharged to home.
Right.
They don't want to go to a skilled nursing facility. And so you've got that we've got to figure out a way to provide non-medical home care services in the home for people that need it, and do it at the level of and have the same outcomes as home health or skilled nursing,
right,
but do it with I hate to use the word lower skilled, but it is a less credentialed workforce. So I do think we're moving in that direction slowly.
Yeah.
One of the challenges we had with working with health systems is we were being used as guinea pigs to do case studies.
Right.
Yeah. And very expensive case studies that you can go out and tell investors, oh, look, I got $1 million contract.
Right.
Wink, wink. It's not a contract. It's a test of change from an academic medical center.
Right.
And for inexperienced investors, it looks like a contract, but it's not.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we were kind of, that's where I say, like, you're kind of dragged out in the middle of the ocean and left there to do this big, expensive case study. And then there's no promise of a contract at the end of it.
Yeah. We know that we know that whole experience very well.
Sure,
also, our mutual acquaintance, Josh Luke, also had been a guest on the podcast, but he actually talks about that quite a bit, about how post-acute providers are coming into the space now and starting to get our time, but that we're not at the point where we can demand much yet. And so a lot of the things that we're doing, like you said, are more of these experimental or test of change things, not necessarily company boosting or huge revenue boosting contracts in different scenarios like that. Kind of on that note, so obviously you guys eventually started to pivot towards another direction, and we do want to get to that in just a little bit, but you had referenced your Medium article that you wrote when you decided that Home Hero was going to be no more or at least not exist in the capacity that it currently had. And there was a response that was written by the HCAOA, Home Care Association of America. And there are just two points that I just wanted to ask you about that he had referenced. One, he referenced in there that high touch beats high tech. That was his quote for one of the sections of the article. One, I'd just like to get your thoughts on that. But also, do you think that the way that you had Home Hero structured, that that's necessarily mutually exclusive, or that that wasn't necessarily what you were going for there?
So I think you're referring to Phil, right? So the question was, does high touch beat high tech?
Yeah.
It can. I think in home care, high touch does tend to win.
Yeah.
And you can have fancy website and apps and everything else, but it's such a game of trust.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the things going for you with, you know, even with 24-hour home care, you guys have been doing this for 8 to 10 years, and you know, you have all of these referral sources that you've built up over many, many years. And so I think it's very hard to come in with technology and rip away those relationships.
Yeah.
And so home care is a hyper local and fragmented industry, which makes it very attractive for venture to come in and consolidate.
Right.
It's very hard unless you're going to do a big M&A play where you're just going to buy up a bunch of home care agencies. But now you're a holding company. You're not really adding a lot of efficiencies to that operations. Like, yeah, I can go in and buy 5 home care agencies and I can fire the support team and send it to Bangladesh. But like, maybe I get some, you know, maybe I reduce some costs there. But at the end of the day, like, these guys want you to come and drive to their house. You want them to come and visit them in person. And, you know, I think that tech will make things more efficient from like a matching standpoint, which I think is something we did very well. I think tech will make things more efficient in terms of collecting data in the home and predictive insights from in the home. That's why I think companies like ClearCare are going to continue to be successful.
Yeah.
They're all tech, right? I mean, it's obviously B2B play, but I think that you still need technology. And one of the things that we learned, and I eat a big piece of humble pie here by saying like that the home care agency is not stuck in the stone ages with technology.
Yeah.
They're not. And we thought that going in. And I admit that that was something we learned, that they are not, there is more technology being utilized than we think.
Yeah.
Now, I feel like we were doing it better? Yeah. But was it a core differentiator for us? A little bit when we were a matching marketplace, but in the W-2 model, not really.
Yeah.
Like we found ourselves just, our product roadmap looked like building ClearCare. And we're like, well, what are we doing here? You know?
And so you mentioned the localness of home care, and we agree because so much of it is currently based on relationships. I think that's just where it's boiling down to in the current climate of home care. So you guys were in operation for 4 years, just over 4 years. What markets had you entered at that point? Because obviously you had said at the beginning you were able to scale really quickly, but what markets were you in at that point?
So we never actually left California.
Yeah.
We had done a lot of market research, even interviewed general managers in other cities. We were exploring a pilot in Southeast Michigan. Mm-hmm. We never actually left California. So we had launched Los Angeles, Orange County, San Diego, and then the whole Bay Area.
Yeah.
We found the Bay Area to be a nightmare.
Yeah.
I think San Francisco was just a terrible market for home care. I think you'll find like the East Bay was a little warmer to go home. But it was just like the biggest challenge for us was the cars. Like, because we didn't know whether or not to require our caregivers to have cars.
Sure.
Because some of them didn't have cars. Like, well, I use BART, but I'm like, what if I match you to somebody down in like Palo Alto? Like, how are you going to get there? You know, if they're off the line. So that was just a weird, San Francisco was just a very weird city. And so we ended up, I mean, to be transparent, most of our clients were not actually in San Francisco proper. They were in the outskirts of the Bay Area. So
San Francisco itself is so challenging to work inside of anyway, because they have their own regulatory market within the city. It's just a challenge. So you guys had explosive growth and you know, Home Hero gained a level of notoriety that I think all other home care companies strive to. So what was your client census? How fast were you able to grow that? I know you said that you had a huge number of caregivers, at least at the beginning, and I would imagine that you were able to transfer a fair amount of those over. How big were you able to grow there?
So we were able to help a little over 1,000 patients over the course of our lifetime as a company in varying levels of engagement.
Yeah. Right.
And most of those clients actually were utilizing us on a lot on some shorter term basis. So I think the average is probably like 16 hours is probably what the home care a week is what you're getting. And so we found ourselves finding a lot of clients that their caregiver was going on vacation or is sick or something. And we were like last minute fill in.
Yeah.
And then they would fall in love with the new caregiver and maybe start, you know, using us part time, maybe a little more full time. But because you could find it, we could find you a caregiver so fast, and they were vetted, they were interviewed, you could see a video interview, they were background check, and we had so many of them, we were just used for a lot of short-term fill-ins. And then of course you've got kind of 80-20 where you start getting your whales, so to speak, a lot of the live-ins. But when the Department of Labor ruling hit us, like having to backtrack on I remember having, you know, lunch with Tyner and your team, and we're like, what the fuck, like this sucks. You know. And so that was kind of the beginning of the end for us on the, like, even 1099. I'm like, man, if we're not, like, we're this big marketplace, but we can't even go after these bigger clients anymore. Or you've got to cycle all these caregivers through. And it was a disaster for our clients. Like, we're going and telling an Alzheimer's patient, oh, by the way, because of a Department of Labor ruling, we've got to throw four different caregivers at you in a week because they can't go over 40 hours.
Exactly.
You know, and it's like,
and sleep time is gone.
And I'm like, so you have these continuity of care issues with these clients that, you know, frankly, they're, a lot of them were confused. It sucked for the caregivers. It increased transportation times. Caregivers were making less money because we were kicking them out at 40 hours. And I literally can't think of a single winner of this except for the labor unions. So, and I'm not throwing SEIU under the bus, but I just think that this was a very misguided piece of legislation.
When you were in the 1099 model at first, one thing we couldn't compete with you on either was price. And that was one of the things that you were very vocal about, wanting Home Hero to be that more affordable option. So what did that change do for the revenue for Home Hero? Did it make a huge impact? What were the numbers like?
So look, I mean, when we were operating at $15 an hour, which even looking at back now is kind of crazy, we were paying our caregivers good wages. They were making like $13 of the $15, and we were, you know, charging $15, but you know, you can't, our OPEX didn't look great there. I mean, it was propped up by venture dollars. And, you know, I think that a lot of early stage venture companies will do that really to kind of eat up a market. And then, you know, just like Uber, they raised, you know, a dollar safe ride fee. What the hell is that? Right. Like, so, you know, that's, it's a natural tendency. You compete on price early. You get a lot of customers in the door, you grow, you raise capital, and then slowly you kind of figure out the business model. Not saying that that's what we were trying to do, but it's just kind of what we fell into. When we increased, $19 was our sweet spot. I think that was, we were still below the market. We were at 1099. We were paying the caregivers 15. We had a healthier margin built
which
into
is well
there.
Above market average for caregivers.
Yeah, pay. Exactly. And so we were paying caregivers more, and we were below market average. 19, that was like kind of where we started finding a sweet spot. We had about a 15% margin on there. So that was much better and healthier. But when we went up to 22 and 23, like, God, we saw a larger decrease in patients than we expected. And the reason is we were getting beat by local home care agencies. And we were like, man, we don't have a lot of, we didn't have a big field marketing, field rep team. We didn't have a lot of boots on the ground. And so we suddenly found ourselves doing home safety inspections, home audits, drop-ins, and in-person consultations. And I'm like, what the hell? This is not a tech company anymore.
So you mentioned tech company. We've seen some organizations go out and have their caregivers utilize technology, utilize maybe an iPad or their phone. And I was curious about the logistics behind that. If the caregivers were required to use that, did they have to use kind of their own phones? Should these companies be supplying the phones? Like, how does that work?
And also, just to piggyback on that too, because you guys were actually involved in some really exciting tech programs, like the Tech Stars, that was brand new, and the inclusion of home care was a really big deal for. So not only that, but can you also, obviously, it wasn't just a text message service to say the caregiver was there anymore. Can you just expand a little bit also on what kind of it evolved to be, not giving away the farm, sure. you know, the secrets or anything, but what the app itself also evolved to be?
So our shining achievement, I would say, at Home Hero was really the mobile apps and that back end and that technology. It was a thing that we had built that the industry just didn't have. And we're still sitting on those assets, and they're very valuable to us. And I think can be valuable to other companies in the home care space. What we had built was an electronic clock-in system, which by itself isn't hugely unique, but the way that we did it, I think, was just really good. I mean, you can clock in and clock out even without an internet connection, and we would store those time clocks. And then at the end of every shift, we would do a patient survey, essentially evaluation, that was based on a series of evidence-based questions that was specific to that patient and what their disease cohorts.
Yeah.
And so we actually worked with Andre Ostrovsky, the chief medical officer of Medicaid, on building out this giant library of evidence-based questions and building this kind of triaging system to collect information and insights from within the home and then relay that back to care managers. And so that was huge for us, because we were able to actually, at the end of every shift, we were able to turn caregivers into better caregivers. They were able to tell them what to look for and say, hey, are they having trouble putting on their shoes? That might be indicative of swollen feet. Yeah. That might be predictive of an adverse event. And so we were able to get ahead of a lot of these events before they occurred. And these were not, this wasn't rocket science. I mean, this was like, hey, they're at a fall risk. Like, do they have any boxes or like crunched up carpets on the floor? Like, these are a lot of non-medical questions, right?
Right.
And so that technology was I think, a differentiator for us. Unfortunately, it matters a lot more to health systems and at-risk entities and home care agencies than it did to families.
Yeah.
We're like, I can't walk into a consultation with a family and talk to them about predictive insights.
Right.
It's just like, what?
We see that a lot, too. And we see that in some sad ways, too, where some families either aren't close enough distance-wise to have those things really mean that much, or that they're getting home care because they can't be involved at the home. And so some of the predictive things don't translate as much to the families as it does to the providers, like you mentioned. And so, so were caregivers using their own equipment there? Because we also see a lot of new companies coming in where it's like putting a tablet in the home or things like that. Yeah. Yours was actually caregiver point of focus, right?
Yeah. So we explored the idea of having our hardware in the home, which I think is what Home Team's doing. We found that to be a nightmare, or we expected it to be a nightmare. We talked to the general manager at Uber in LA, who's a friend of mine, and he was like, don't go that direction. He's like, if you don't have to, because buying phones for people, and they're going to lose them, they're going to break them, they're not working, they have to upgrade them, and you know, you've got to get data plans on them. And it was such a nightmare. So we actually just made it a requirement for all caregivers to have a cell phone, which I thought would be more of a challenge. But what I realized is actually 95% of the caregivers had a smartphone.
Yeah.
And what they didn't have was a laptop.
Yeah.
They didn't always have a laptop, but they would go and buy the expensive, they would spend the money that they would spend on a laptop on having a better smartphone. And so we actually found it not to be a problem at all that we required an iPhone or an Android in order to use Home Hero. And it very rarely did it block somebody. Maybe we had a few Windows phones in there. We would loan them a phone, but beyond that, that was just a requirement. And no, if we could avoid owning hardware, like, we're going to do that to the rest of my life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so you had referenced something earlier, and as we kind of transition into what you're doing now, what your team is doing, but you had made a comment earlier that stood out to me, because Gavin and I were at a healthcare breakfast not long ago, and it was four or five hospital CEOs up in Northern California. And one of the CEOs was talking about technology, and she said that typically when technology really disrupts an industry, it makes it more accessible and cheaper. And that the issue that we're having in healthcare right now is that there's a lot of new technology that's really exciting that's coming in, but it's not necessarily getting more accessible or cheaper yet. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that? Do you agree? What are your thoughts on
specific
that?
To home care or the healthcare?
No,
in
she was talking about healthcare in general, because she was even talking about, you know, expensive new hospital equipment that can do all this amazing things, but it costs an exorbitant amount more to provide those treatments than old ways.
So we're in a situation where we have one of the most inefficient healthcare systems in the world. Yeah. If you look at the amount of money that we spend and what the outcomes are, I think that technology companies are very distracted by technology and don't spend enough time with patients and really understanding. Like I look at the new company Forward that's out and they've got these shiny walls and I went in. It's amazing. It's like a GameStop or something. And it's just all this fancy stuff to play with. And the question really comes down to me, are you guys making patients healthier? Are you improving outcomes? And it's such a boring question to answer all the time in healthcare, but it comes down to outcomes. And so, and at what cost? And so I often question just, are we getting in our own way with technology sometimes where just because we can make an AI chatbot on Alexa, should we do it? Right? Is that actually better care? Is that what people, is that what patients really want? Or are we doing it because we can? I think HealthTap just launched an AI chatbot and I played with it. It was cool.
Yeah.
But when I had a fever, I went and called the doctor. I didn't use a chatbot. So again, I'm bullish on some of that technology, but I think it just, we need to, when you are building, doing any product development, you need to have consistent feedback from patients.
Yeah.
Do they want to interact with a robot, you know, on their healthcare, or do they want a human touch?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't know. I think that it's probably the latter for a while.
Yeah,
you know, as something as intimate as your health. But for you know, when I'm catching a, when I'm calling an Uber, Alexa, call me an Uber. I don't need a human touch. So I think we're going to see just kind of like we did in the wearables market, where just because we can build something doesn't necessarily mean it's actually improving outcomes and making people interact with their health more. So.
Well, speaking about technology and the molding of the person touch and the technology touch, the other reason that we're really excited to have you here is because you are launching out on a new venture. Please first tell us about it, but also, is it the Home Hero team too? Do you have a lot of the same people there? And what is it? Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So the last 6 months have been probably the craziest time of my life. We've just been a lot of ups and downs, just emotionally and, you know, The worst part of the last 6 months is letting go of, we had a 30-person team and we let go about 20 people. And that was the hardest thing for me. And I, you know, I've been pleased to see some of my employees are going and working at 24-hour, even Honor and others. And so, and I'm rooting for them. I'm rooting for all of them. And those are people that I've built really good relationships with over the last few years. And that part sucked. It really did. In December, we let go of most of the team with the exception of the engineers and the executives and a few operations folks. But that really sucked. It was my least favorite part of the last 4 years is just making a commitment. And a lot of these employees they'll take pay cuts to be here and they just take big gambles. And, you know, for it not to fully pay off is just frustrating. But that being said, and I'll answer your question in a second, but that being said, you know, we were able to provide, you know, over 1 million hours of home care to families and touch the lives of thousands of people. And so it was not in vain at all. So that's kind of an aside. So we did let go of most of the team in December, and Mike and I really just spent time brainstorming what we wanted to do next. And normally you should do things the other way around, but we had a lot of pending contracts and RFPs that we had to respond to. And by deciding not to do them, it kind of just sealed our fate. And we said, well, you know, there's no point keeping this alive if we're like backtracking on 7 months of sales funnel here. So we gave most of our team the month off in December, and Mike and I just, instead of doing Christmas, we really just hammered on ideas. And, you know, we came to a couple conclusions. And by the way, we had full support from the board to go any direction we wanted, which is something that I think is just a testament to the trust that we built between each other. And so we really had two observations over that month long sprint of really to figure out what we wanted to do. And, you know, the first thing was, is that Americans today are sicker than they've ever been. You know, we have about 117 million Americans, about half of adults are dealing with some sort of chronic health condition.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, we, as I said a couple minutes ago, we have the most inefficient and expensive healthcare system in the world. And one of the reasons for that is really just because Our healthcare system is not designed to keep people out of the hospital. It's not designed to help people be healthier. We have a system that's designed for reimbursement. It's fee for service. And doctors are not incentivized to spend a lot of time with patients. The average patient visits about 13 minutes on average, with a large cohort at under 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And so that's not enough time to actually take a holistic understanding of somebody's health and help them find natural ways of curing some of their chronic conditions. And so what you have is you have a healthcare system that you spend 10 minutes in a doctor and 80% of the time they're going to write you a prescription. Right. You know, you could have a headache, you could have a bellyache, you could have eczema, and you're getting a prescription 80% of the time.
Right.
And so what we saw is really an immense opportunity to build a service in the integrative medicine and preventative health space. And so the company that we're launching is called Harvey. The website is goharvey.com. And really the way that we define the company is as it's a telehealth provider of personalized and integrative medicine. And we're going to be providing virtual consultations with functional naturopathic doctors, in-home lab testing, and then natural therapies to help patients reach optimal levels of health and wellness. And I'll oftentimes find the root cause of their chronic health condition instead of just focus on treating the symptoms with prescription drugs.
Right. Yeah.
So, and really we're riding the coattails of three major trends in healthcare right now, which I think, by the way, you can build successful venture businesses in each one of these.
Okay.
And we're kind of putting them all together. But the first one really is in telehealth. You know, Kaiser, for example, said by 2019, they want over 50% of all of their patient interactions to be through telehealth.
Yeah.
So that's just one statistic alone, just showing the direction. And they're one of the most reputable health systems in the world.
Yeah.
But the growth of telehealth has been undeniable. The second one has really been in the holistic wellness space. You know, you've got about 50% of Americans take a dietary supplement every single day. You've got about half of adults are dealing with some sort of chronic disease, as I mentioned. And you've got about $40 billion that are spent on complementary and alternative medicine services. This can be everything from massage to yoga to preventative medicine, even to Tai Chi, to nutrition and weight loss. There's just this entire category of health and wellness with a lot of overlap. And the third one I think is most exciting that I've seen as a trend, at least in the last couple of years, is the growth of integrative medicine. You guys, I know, work pretty closely with UCLA, and they launched, I think it's Center for East-West Medicine. Cedars is launching Centers for Integrative Medicine. I've got a list here, like Mayo Clinic, Duke, Johns Hopkins, Stanford, are all launched Centers for Integrative Medicine. And I'm like, wait a minute, you're a Western hospital and you're bringing in Eastern medicine, alternative medicine, wellness programs into the top and most reputable hospitals in the country. So the idea really between Harvey is to improve access, awareness, and affordability of integrative and naturopathic medicine and make it easier for people to find the root cause of those chronic health conditions instead of just ignoring them, instead of just relying on prescription drugs and taking a holistic approach to medicine that I feel like has just been missing so much in our industry.
Yeah. So I have a couple of questions because it's exciting. I mean, I don't think, obviously there's a big push for it, but I don't think there's anything quite like what you're describing. One, why Harvey?
Yeah.
Where did Harvey come from? Is there any significance?
I can only start companies that start with H. So okay. That was one rule. William Harvey was an English scientist that actually discovered how blood streams through the body.
Yep.
And so Harvey was just the code name for this project that we were working on in November and December. And then I don't know, when it came time to pick the name, we just, I don't know, it stuck. It was short and easy to remember. So
yeah,
we went with Harvey.
And just before we jump into more questions there, just because in case listeners don't know, you mentioned all of those programs that are starting integrative medicine programs. Can you just give a brief idea? What does integrative medicine mean?
Yeah. So integrative medicine combines kind of traditional healing philosophies of Eastern medicine with more advanced evidence-based research of Western medicine. And when people hear alternative medicine, there's a little bit of a stigma. I don't actually like the word alternative. I like integrative because we shouldn't be an alternative. It should be complementary to Western medicine, not an alternative. And the idea is that when people talk about Eastern medicine, it's very basic things like nutrition, which is the best medication that we have.
Absolutely.
It's about anti-stress. It's about happiness. And a lot of times when patients are sick, they don't need they don't need Western medicine. They might need a puppy and a friend,
yeah.
you know?
right.
And well so said. I think that there's just so much to say. When we hear music therapy, I think a lot of doctors get like, oh, that's so, that's all quackery. And I was like, well, this is just a very basic concept of thinking more holistically about people's health. So really integrative medicine focuses on the whole person, not just the symptoms, and uses a variety of natural therapies to find the root cause and do root cause analysis to help people heal them of their natural, of chronic symptom. But that is really integrative medicine. It is incorporating Eastern and Western. And as just a quick aside, most hospitals or health systems that have centers of integrative medicine might have a functional doctor. So this is a MD with an Eastern lean,
yeah.
who really puts an emphasis on lab testing and nutrition. They might have a naturopathic doctor, an ND, a license in that state, an acupuncturist, a chiropractor, and then some I've even seen have a traditional Chinese medicine doctor. Yeah. So it's usually about five modalities or practitioners that they would use.
Okay, cool. So when you were explaining Harvey, you mentioned access, awareness, and affordability. So right away, I think AAA, I think the auto club. But that's not the case. So are you able to share a little bit about how folks, I guess all three, how can they access this care and how much does it cost or how are you reimbursed?
Yeah. So this is all cash pay, which has strengths and weaknesses from a business standpoint. But this is all cash pay. And we really believe that the best healthcare that you can get right now, you're typically going to have to pay for it out of pocket, because it's really hard to get a doctor to spend 3 hours with you yeah. and really go deep into your health.
We've actually had people on the podcast that was their business model as physicians, is the cash pay model, so that you can access them all the time. So totally, we're familiar yeah. with it here. Yeah.
So the idea of how Harvey works is basically there's four steps. You'd first have a telehealth consultation with an integrative physician. So there's either a doctor of osteopathy, a functional MD, or a naturopathic doctor. Okay. A naturopathic doctors have been most popular. They're slightly less expensive. They're licensed. They've gone to four-year medical school. They've gotten a medical license in the state that they're practicing. And they typically tend to be, they have a lot more education around nutrition in medical school. So the average doctor, MD, gets less than 24 hours of education around nutrition in med school. It's atrocious.
Wow.
So the naturopathic doctors will spend a lot more time there. And so that's actually been in the highest demand. So you have a telehealth consultation. So everything you do with Harvey, you don't have to leave your home. So you're in your home, you have a consultation with your physician, and then—
Is that via smartphone?
Yeah. So we'll do, it's a telehealth play. So you have a video consultation with a doctor. The doctor, about 70% of the time, will prescribe some sort of lab test. And our lab tests are not traditional lab tests. These are micronutrient, they're allergies, they're hormone panels, they're toxic metal panels, they're toxic chemicals to find out what kind of household toxins are in the air or the water that we drink. So these are not typically tests that you're going to get by your primary care doctor. So we'll actually send you a kit, we'll mail you a kit, and 50% of our tests will actually involve a blood draw. So we'll actually send you a phlebotomist in the home, a phlebotomist is someone who draws blood,
yeah.
and do the blood draw. And or if it's something more fun, like a stool sample, you can do it on your own. And you get to mail that, send it off in the mail. And some lucky lab gets to open that up, and they'll do the lab test, and they'll we have integrations with all these labs. We take down all of the results, and we'll give those right back to you on your smartphone or your desktop computer.
Okay.
And then the last step is really just we do the root cause analysis. You'll have a follow-up with the doctor, review the results. Most of the time, they'll get prescribed some nutraceuticals. So these are vitamins, supplements, or lifestyle changes, nutritional changes. You should cut this out of your diet. You're showing an allergy to gluten. You don't have your eczema is, you don't need to take prescription drugs for. You're just allergic to gluten. And so if we cut that out, we're going to find that is the root cause. And so a lot of it's not rocket science, right? It takes time to actually go through and go take a deeper dive. The consultations are $150. The lab tests will range from $99 to about $300 is our most expensive. So, you know, it's a pretty penny, but it's worth it. And you're a lot of the amount of patients that we've talked to this has changed their life. It's been phenomenal just being able to hear the stories. And so that's one of our challenges one of the opportunities over the next year is to really capture these patient stories and show people that if they're dealing with some of these chronic illnesses, that they're not alone.
Yeah.
You mentioned primary care. Does it integrate with primary care, or is it just a tool for people to have as they're trying to take command of their own health?
Well, we have to be careful proposing that we can fully replace your primary care doctor. I think there's a time to go to your primary care physician. That being said, a lot of our patients go to their ND or their doctor of osteopathy or their functional doctor as their primary doctor. And just like anyone else, we refer out to specialists. If you say, hey, I've got this pain in my foot and I've got a bunion, yeah, we're not going to give you supplements. We're going to refer you to a podiatrist, right? So we're not trying to keep people away from one modality over the other here. We are just trying to be the point of entry for most patients just because we have a philosophy of finding root cause before we write prescriptions.
Now, that makes sense. One thing we talked about off the air, as we were discussing the show, is with Home Hero, you guys made this pivot at the end of the year when you still had majority of the funding left.
Yeah.
And that was impressive that you guys made that firm decision with a lot of resources still behind you. And you mentioned the board was fully supportive. Was that an easy decision?
No, it was the hardest decision of my life. we did have a fair amount of funding. Mike and I have always been pretty frugal with our spending, and being in Los Angeles, we spend less money too than in the Bay. And so there's a lot of elements that just, we were fortunate enough not to burn all of our capital. And
yeah.
And I think that's why we were given some leverage with the board to say, hey, we want to go to this other thing. And, you know, look, we got to the point where we felt like we were pushing the boulder up the hill and we just needed to do something else. And we feel that we have a better chance at getting that $100 million plus exit with Harvey than we did with the W-2 home care agency with Home Hero. And so at the end of the day, like, you know, we learned economics 101. It's a sunk cost of what you spent already. And all that matters is right now, if you've got $10 or $15 million, is it better to make a play in integrative medicine and personalized medicine or in a W-2 home care agency?
Yeah.
And for us, we just felt like we could grow faster doing Harvey. And so as tough as a decision it was, that, you know, the worst thing to do is keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result.
Yeah.
And
so it's goharvey.com. Mm-hmm. When is it going to be live for people? And if people want to connect, is it best through the website or is there going to be an app that they can download directly? How is it going to work for them?
So it's all through web right now. We're in the process of introducing a mobile component. We'll be launching at the end of May. So by the time you're hearing this podcast, it should be live. We're starting small. I mean, we're not doing any big national push here. You know, we're a 10-person team and we've seen about 20 patients so far, and we've talked to about two dozen other patients and had them into our office and shared their stories. And the thing I'm most proud of right now is we've got a YouTube channel for Harvey that just has all of the patient stories.
Nice.
People that have had fibromyalgia or eczema, or they've got lupus or Crohn's disease, and they found an integrative physician and it changed their life. And so those stories, honestly, are the thing that I'm most proud of right now. But yeah, you can get started at goharvey.com.
Awesome. Okay. And like Kyle mentioned, by the time you're hearing this episode, that website will be live. So please go ahead and check it out.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask for folks listening, where do they need to live to access Harvey?
So we actually are, despite kind of focusing our marketing efforts a little more locally, we can't actually service patients in most states.
Oh,
there's
wow.
a few exceptions: New York, Alabama, and Tennessee. I think there's just some regulatory hurdles there around the blood testing. Most states, we can service. And yeah, if you mention just this podcast, I'll give everyone a 25% off on the blood testing and the consultation. So, love to get your feedback on that and.
Perfect.
Help you solve some of those nagging health issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, again, mention Pop Health Podcast. I think this is our first episode where we're actually saving people
That's
money
right.
for listening.
Yeah.
I think you just gave me an idea for future shows.
Hey, 25%. I mean, it can be a lot of money on
absolutely.
Some of these
tests. Absolutely. So. And again, that's goharvey.com. Well, Kyle, I've been looking forward to this show.
Yeah.
To be upfront, for many months when we came up with the idea. Really, really appreciate for being open with us and the audience, being vulnerable with us. And, you know, you are an entrepreneur and you've seen lots of success, and we wish you the most success with GoHarvey. And, you know, let's stay connected and see if we can help you in any way. Totally.
We've always respected what you're doing. It was fun to compete directly against you, but it'll be fun to be able to work alongside with you now. So best of luck with Harvey.
Yeah, thank you guys. And I say this very genuinely. I really am rooting for home care and all the agencies and even the venture-backed companies in this space. And I really do want to be a resource and because I this is still an industry that matters a lot to me. And I've got parents that are getting old and think about it all the time, what kind of care they're going to get when that time comes. So I want the state of the industry to improve.
Great. Well, thanks again, Kyle. It was a pleasure.
Likewise. Yeah.